From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington.
I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. Climate disasters have dominated the news over the years, from wildfires to hurricanes to drought. And study after study tells us new aspects of this larger climate story. But how do we aggregate that sea of important climate science data? Well, a group of scientists used machine learning to analyze and map more than 100,000 studies in this effort to definitively link escalating weather and climate extremes with the ways we as humans live. They published their work in Nature Climate Change, and they found that 85% of the world's population and 80% of the land are impacted by human-caused climate change. Joining us to discuss this is Richard Alley, a climate scientist at Penn State University. He was not involved in this study, but he joins us to talk more about it. Thank you for being here.
It is my pleasure. Nice to chat with you.
Richard, what does this study of studies tell us that we don't already know?
In some sense, not much. We have known that burning fossil fuels and releasing the CO2 would warm the planet since the 1800s. This has been well known in my whole lifetime, but the knowledge is just getting stronger. It's gone from balance of evidence to pound on the table near certainty. This is real. It's happening. It's affecting us.
Richard, 85% is such a specific percentage of the world's population impacted. At least one climate expert said that percentage is an understatement. To that point, isn't all land impacted by climate change?
Yes, the climate is changing everywhere. There's no way to put a little cylinder around some 15%. Who is really seeing it? Some people more than others. And so you can set some threshold slider and get a number. But yes, everyone's climate is changing, and we really all are seeing it.
Well, in thinking about the future, all of this comes, of course, in the run-up to November's climate summit in Scotland. Do you expect this study to motivate countries to make any better or binding agreements to curb global emissions?
Oh, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be a happy person. It is very strong evidence for them to use. We are, the IPCC, the scientists, eventually come with all of our science, and we put it together, and these hardworking volunteers who worked with the IPCC have done their best to give to the policymakers what the policymakers ask for. The IPCC has said, this really is what's solid. This is what's possible. This is what the uncertainties look like. This is the actionable information. Now it's up to you to take the actions.
Well, Richard, in journalism, some have remarked that over the next decade, every story we cover will likely be a climate story. What are you focused on in the coming decade from a climate perspective?
Yeah, so I think you're right that there is a climate component to everything going forward. Our research group is especially concerned with the issue of large abrupt sea level rise. The projections in this IPCC are challenging. It's 3 feet of rise by 2100 if things go wrong. But that leaves more than 99% of the ice still in Greenland and Antarctica and not melted. And we're working on the possibility that if a little more of that ice goes away, sea level could rise a lot more. The uncertainties in climate science tend to be mostly on the bad side. It could be a little better than we're expecting. It could be a little worse, or we could break something we really care about, and it could be a lot worse. And there isn't so much a lot better to balance the lot worse. So if we let climate change run ahead, the uncertainties look very risky, and that's on ecosystems burning and not growing back, and it's on societies getting mad at each other. Our military leaders have been very clear that climate change is a threat multiplier, that you make people mad enough and sometimes they get together and they solve the problem, and sometimes they get mad at each other and they start shooting things. And so how our human societies adapt to this, and whether we use the information and grab it and build a better future, or whether we get mad at each other, is maybe the most important question.
A test of our humanity.
It is indeed.
That's Richard Alley, a climate scientist at Penn State University. Thank you so much for your time.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
Fall is the time of year when, as we know, many birds fly south for the winter. Thing is, climate change may be affecting their behavior, that is, when and where they migrate. Scientists at the Manomet Observatory in Plymouth, Massachusetts, are now working to track migratory birds on these questions. The observatory is one of the oldest banding labs in North America. And by placing ankle bands on birds, researchers have been tracking the rise and fall of species for more than 50 years. Barbara Moran of member station WBUR reports.
Fall is busy if you're a migrating bird. You gotta spend all day stuffing yourself with bugs and berries to fatten up for the long flight south. It's pretty safe to say that getting caught in a net was not on this bird's to-do list. Megan Gray stoops down and gently untangles the bird. It's slate gray, a little smaller than a pigeon, with a sweeping, graceful tail.
What is it?
So this is a gray catbird, one of our most commonly banded birds at Manomet.
Oh, it already has a band.
It already has a band. So we banded this bird probably a week or so ago, and he's still been here. He's been fattening up for migration, and we just caught him again.
Gray, one of the lead banders at Manomet, gently slides the bird into a small cloth bag. This time of year, the banders can catch 100 birds a day in the half mile of nets stretched alongside paths in the woods.
This is one of our nets. It's called a mist net. It basically looks like a 7-foot-tall, 40-foot-long hairnet.
Evan Dalton is the director of the Manomet Observatory, which has been catching, banding, and tracking birds since the 1960s. He says birds do a lot for humans. They attract tourists, they eat tons of bugs, and they give us clues about how the planet's holding up. When the birds aren't doing so well, it's usually because something in the ecosystem is out of whack.
Many people have come to the realization that birds are fantastic indicators of ecological health. We're actually able to study movements of birds throughout hemispheres at this point, just through simple bird banding practices even.
The team walks the nets exactly once each hour, from about dawn to dusk, carefully gathering every bird they find, including woodpeckers, wrens, the occasional hawk, and lots of catbirds.
So another catbird?
Yes. Another great catbird.
The team brings the birds back to the lab, measures and weighs them, checks their ages and sex. Then they give each new bird a tiny numbered band around its ankle. They record all the information on the computer. Then they set the birds free.
People that do this, they care immensely about the birds that we're handling.
Amy Hogan is one of the bird banders.
We've got it down pretty much to an art that we can usually get a bird processed out of a net and out and back in the world in like 10 minutes. The data is not more important to us than the bird is.
The data are important, though. The information collected at Manomet over 5 decades shows a striking decline in a majority of migrating bird species. Their findings parallel a landmark 2019 study reporting 3 billion fewer birds in the U.S. and Canada now than in 1970. Scientists call that, quote, a staggering loss that suggests the very fabric of North America's ecosystem is unraveling. Evan Dalton says the reasons for population decline vary from species to species. There are still lots of catbirds here in Massachusetts, for instance, but they travel thousands of miles each year. Losing a remote habitat to development, sea level rise, or wildfires can hurt them.
It has a breeding territory. It's got spots that it likes to stop at during its southward migration. And then it has a territory on its wintering ground. So this bird could have a dozen or more spots that are very important to its annual cycle. The loss of one of those could completely throw them on a tailspin.
Climate change has helped some bird species. Warmer winters have led to way more Carolina wrens and northern cardinals in the Northeast than there used to be. But warmer, earlier springs are leading to earlier insect hatchings, and that could throw migrating birds off their game. The birds may show up in May to gorge on green caterpillars, only to find the bugs have already come and gone. It's called an ecological mismatch, and it can become way more common with climate change. Back at the lab, the banders look up the number of that catbird they caught earlier. Turns out it was born last summer.
So yeah, that bird hatched out in a nest last year, and then it migrated south somewhere. It could have gone as far as the Yucatan, and then it's come through again. So it spent time building up fat along the coast, and it liked it, so it's going to come back.
To Mexico and back is a long way for a little bird to fly. And that journey in itself has a lot to teach us, says Dalton. Birds see the world without borders, as one interconnected and interdependent ecosystem. To protect them, and ourselves, from the worst effects of climate change, he says, maybe a bird's eye view is just what we need. For Here and Now, I'm Barbara Moran.
For customers of Southwest Airlines, the cancellation nightmare appears over today. But over the weekend and Monday, Southwest canceled more than 2,000 flights. The airline blamed weather, air traffic, staffing. Although every other airline not named Southwest seemed to keep a relatively normal schedule. So what's going on? Let's go to Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. And Seth, how did this debacle begin for Southwest late last week?
It remains somewhat of a mystery, Scott, because as you said, the airline has blamed weather and air traffic control and things that affect every airline, and yet no other airline had anything nearly on the scale of Southwest. We do know that Southwest's pilots last week asked the judge to intervene with a new mandate that they all be vaccinated for COVID, but keep that separate, sort of. Because nobody has come out and said that that's the reason for it. The airline and pilots union have both denied that there's any connection between that. And we're at 1,000 cancellations Sunday alone, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are just kind of staggering through Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. I mean, there was some weather on Friday, I gather, and issues with the FAA. Let's take a listen to Southwest CEO Gary Kelly. He spoke on ABC News this morning.
Things are much improved today, and essentially all this starts with a series of FAA Florida delay programs on Friday. About half of our airplanes touched the state of Florida. Orlando, as an example, had a ground stop for 7 hours.
Okay, so blaming the FAA, and I guess related to that, if they had a lot of planes and a lot of crew members in the wrong places. But Seth, as you step back, do they seem to be coming clean or no?
Well, again, the first thing I always do is look at the impact on other airlines at the same airports. Now, of course, there are times when one airline is more greatly impacted than another when something happens, depending on where airlines fly, right? If something goes wrong in Chicago, that's a problem for United and American with hubs at O'Hare and for Southwest at Midway. But in this case, you have other airlines at those same airports, and the numbers just weren't anything on the scale. The pilots union has come out and said, well, the Southwest is basically just kind of running things too tightly, and when something goes wrong, this is what happens. Things cascade, and indeed, that is something that can happen with airlines, right? If you don't have a lot of slack in your schedule, that then one little thing can cause a lot. But hard on a day when you look at, again, you talk about like Sunday, where you're 2 days removed from that, and Southwest had almost 1,100 cancellations. American was number two that day with something like 80 cancellations. And they fly to a lot of the same airports as Southwest. Huge Florida exposure to Delta, by the way, had 3 cancellations everywhere in the world. So that doesn't quite add up, does it?
Yeah. I mean, okay. If you take Southwest side for a second here, they did have a lot of planes and staff members in the wrong places. We've seen staffing shortages across sectors in the economy. Could that be part of this here, that they just don't have the worker redundancy to get the workers to where they need to go?
Oh, no question, that's part of it. And for example, well, what do you do when your flight is canceled? You might want to call the airline, but a lot of these airlines, Southwest included, have staffing shortages at their call centers, right? So, I mean, there's certainly truth to that, that these airlines, which have kind of tried to ramp up to meet increased demand as the pandemic to some degree subsides, just aren't as well staffed as they should be, especially after they got so many employees to take voluntary buyouts when the pandemic was at its worst.
And as I think about the customers here, and many of us have been there, we've all probably been there before, why do airlines almost provide no information about flight delays and cancellations? We just often get stuck there and wait for information that doesn't come.
Yeah, and sometimes there really is a confluence of reasons, right? Something that might be partly due to weather, might also have, there might be other reasons too, right? Where it could be also mechanical, could be also something beyond the airline's control. But you're right, it's interesting that, you know, when you think of how regulated of an industry this is in certain regards when it comes to customer service, and we think about the tarmac delay and the fines, United paying millions of dollars in fines because of that, that you can have a 1,000 cancellations and no regulation truly saying that you have to, let's say, go on your website and say, this is exactly what happened, even though there are certain things, of course, that airlines have to do for their customers.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe more answers forthcoming in the coming days. That's Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan on the case. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
Well, if you have a pet, you've probably noticed it's taking a lot longer to see a veterinarian. Or maybe you've had a pet emergency and all the hospitals have been full. The country's vet system is under stress, a situation made worse by COVID. From Northwest News Network, Austin Jenkins has more.
Chambers Creek Veterinary House, how may I help you?
At Chambers Creek Veterinary Hospital in Lakewood, Washington, they're not taking new patients.
No availability at all on new patients. I'm so sorry.
And even existing patients have a hard time getting an appointment.
We're scheduling 3 to 4 weeks out.
This is Dr. Kelly Sandmeyer. She says the few same-day appointments they have fill up almost immediately.
People are calling right as they open, and they all just go super fast.
It's not just this clinic. Across the country, the COVID-19 pandemic has brought what some call a perfect storm to veterinary medicine. Early on, procedures and surgeries were delayed because of PPE shortages, creating a backlog. Then with schools closed and kids at home, it was hard to keep staff. Meanwhile, demand for veterinary services increased during the pandemic. Now, Dr. Sandmeyer says compassion fatigue is setting in, leading to more resignations in an industry that long before COVID had workforce challenges.
I mean, it's very stressful and tiring, you know. You don't want to be able to help as many pets as you can, which is why we got into this industry, and not being able to do that is hard.
Emergency animal hospitals are also overwhelmed.
At this time, our emergency service is closed due to staffing issues.
That's the message callers to Olympia veterinary specialists are likely to get these days. Dr. Lisa Parshley is the clinic's co-founder.
It's heartbreaking. I'm here because I love animals.
Parshley says she even had to say no to a friend of hers with a sick dog. He eventually got in his car and headed for a clinic more than 100 miles away in Portland, Oregon.
And his dog died on the way to Portland. It's stories like that that will burn us out, because I can tell you I still cry and tear up over it.
It was a better ending, but no less harrowing for my friend Emily Wyan and her dog Ranger, a 3-year-old Bernese Mountain Dog, heard here eagerly greeting Emily's daughter. On a recent Sunday evening, Ranger clearly wasn't feeling well. His belly was distended and hard. Emily suspected a stomach flip, a fatal condition if untreated. When she called her local emergency vet, she was told,
"We're sorry, we can't. We are totally over capacity. There's no OR available. There's no surgeon available. There's not even a vet available to evaluate him."
They called a dozen clinics. No luck. Eventually, they reached a clinic that would see their dog. Ranger got x-rays, and the vet confirmed the diagnosis. He needed emergency surgery or he would die. But there was no surgeon available.
And so then we're just really panicking.
With time running out for Ranger, there was only one option left. Let the vet who had diagnosed him attempt the surgery, something she told Emily she'd never done on her own. Ranger made it through and is now home. Emily says they got lucky.
It never would have crossed my mind that you, in a truly, truly life or death emergent situation, we couldn't find someone.
It's not just veterinarians who are in short supply. So are the people who support them. Vet techs, as they're known, are an essential part of any practice. Without enough of them, clinics are reducing hours and even closing, putting more pressure on an already stressed system. The situation is so dire that Seattle Humane issued what its CEO calls a red alert about the veterinary staff shortage.
And right now in the industry, licensed vet techs are pretty much the unicorn.
Christopher Ross says Seattle Humane's own vet clinic is operating at less than 50% of its optimal staffing. It's a similar story, he says, around the country.
It is at an epidemic level in the United States.
But it doesn't have to be this way, says Liz Houston. She's president of a new union that's organizing veterinary professionals.
COVID has really laid bare the problem that we've been facing for a long time. And it's an easy thing, I think, to point a finger at and say, oh, it's the pandemic. And, oh, you know, everybody went out and got a pandemic puppy.
Houston calls the corporatization of veterinary medicine a key factor in the labor crisis. She says pay, benefits, and work conditions for frontline staff are not keeping up as big companies buy out independent clinics. These days, even private equity firms are getting in on the pet care business.
And now here we are in a place where people are crying, labor shortage, labor shortage.
The reality, she says, is the people who work the front desk and assist the vets are sometimes barely making ends meet, and they're leaving the profession.
They're taking advantage of our empathy and our desire to help. And they think there's an unlimited supply, and we're finally coming to realize that there is not an unlimited supply of people to do this work.
At the College of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University, Dean Dori Borgeson says she's looking for ways to expand the pipeline of people getting into veterinary medicine. That means increasing class sizes at the vet school, but also looking at paraprofessional training and certificate programs.
The truth is, becoming a veterinarian is very expensive, and it isn't the right decision for everybody. But we want to take all of those great animal lovers and people who want to be in our profession and find a home for them.
Borgeson says the current situation with veterinary medicine is painful, but she still sees opportunities to improve the profession and access to care in the midst of what many are calling a crisis. For Here and Now, I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia, Washington.
A type of invasive grass is creating headaches for landowners in Kansas. The grass was intentionally planted across the Great Plains decades ago, but now it threatens to wipe out the grassland ecosystem and the state's prairie landscape. David Kondos of the Kansas News Service reports.
This is a story about good intentions gone awry. It goes back to the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, when the federal government planted a foreign grass called Old World Bluestem in the Great Plains to revive land that had been farmed and grazed into oblivion. It was literally blowing away.
The good earth has turned to dust. Soil that once grew wheat now clots the highways.
Back then, highway departments planted it on roadsides to control erosion. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has even encouraged landowners to grow it for conservation. But the traits that made Old World Bluestem so attractive, its prolific growth, its hardy tolerance to drought, are the same things that make it such a problem today. Farmer Orville Moore helped Kansas State University plant the grass for research in the 1980s.
Nature will take over and it'll eat your lunch, so too late now. The horse is out of the barn.
And researchers now say Old World Bluestem is transforming the area's grassland ecosystems into what they fear are biodiversity wastelands. Kansas State University scientist Keith Harmony is crouching down at a research plot in northwest Kansas, near where this school planted the grass decades ago.
In a native pasture, we could see 10, 11, 12 different species all within one single square foot of space. And here, all we see is Old World Bluestem.
Most of this hillside is now covered with a thick blanket of the pale yellow grass that grows about 3 feet tall. While it may not look menacing, this plant is threatening a lot of what makes Kansas, well, Kansas. So why is Old World Bluestem so good at being so bad for prairies?
It's highly competitive, so it can outcompete and outgrow and inhibit the growth of other native plants.
Karen Hickman heads the Environmental Science Program at Oklahoma State University. She says Old World Bluestem even employs a form of biochemical warfare to increase its spread. Her research shows that chemicals it releases into the surrounding dirt hurt the survival of nearby native plants. That's also bad news for the birds and animals relying on the state's 17 million acres of diverse native grassland for food and habitat. The grass threatens the state's multi-billion dollar cattle ranching industry, too. But there are no governmental efforts in Kansas to regulate the grass's spread or mandate its removal. So it's up to landowners to decide for themselves. How much effort do they want to put into fighting a plant that's nearly impossible to get rid of? At his pasture in western Kansas, Randy Rogers paces back and forth, armed with a bucket and a shovel. He's on the hunt for old world blue stem.
And there's my trophy.
Rogers holds up a scraggly clump of grass. He's dug up hundreds of these plants, one by one, over the past few years. And he's slowly seeing native grasses take hold again. But he knows this type of meticulous shovel work just isn't practical for most ranchers. He and others worry that unless local governments step up with a plan to control old world bluestem, or researchers come up with a better way to kill it, it may just be a matter of time before the once diverse Kansas prairie no longer exists. For NPR News, I'm David Kondos in Hays, Kansas.
We're now in the sixth week of the trial of Elizabeth Holmes, founder of Theranos, a startup that claimed it would revolutionize medicine. Holmes faces a dozen federal fraud charges over allegations that she misled investors, doctors, and patients about her company's blood testing technology. She's pleaded not guilty and faces up to 20 years in prison. But before her very public fall from grace, Holmes was considered the quintessential girl boss. Her relentless ambition, billionaire status, and carefully crafted image as the female Steve Jobs made her an inspiration to feminists everywhere. Here's Holmes in 2015 at the Horatio Alger Society talking about being a role model for young girls.
Whenever there's a quote-unquote glass ceiling, there's an iron woman right behind it.
But her defense is casting doubt on her reputation as the all-knowing CEO. They say Holmes' business partner, Sonny Belwani, deceived her about the company's financials and was abusive towards her. Some critics, however, are now asking whether feminism is shielding Elizabeth Holmes from criticism and accountability. And to parse all of this out, let's bring in Anne Coughlin from the University of Virginia. She studies criminal law and feminist jurisprudence. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, well, let's start with that defense, which is a striking contrast to Holmes's public image. Is this defense likely to work in her favor?
It's almost impossible to say right now because we haven't yet heard her testify or heard her side of the case. But the defense that she's raising is certainly in keeping with defenses that women have made for well over 100 years, probably even longer than that. And yes, those defenses have succeeded in the past.
Will it be difficult, you think, though, for jurors to believe that Holmes was both a powerful CEO and a victim of intimate partner violence? And if so, what does that really say about the narratives we have around women in power?
Yes, yeah, so Holmes' case is an absolutely terrific opportunity for the public to think about those narratives and how those narratives shape the lives of real women. So, as you said in your introduction, at the beginning of the case or way back when, Holmes looked like the exemplary feminist success. She was at the absolute top of her game. She was raising huge sums of money for this phenomenal startup, and she was obviously going to be making a big contribution to healthcare around the world and so forth. She looked like she was the kind of poster child for what feminists has aimed to achieve, that is to make the economic world equally available to women and to men. And then suddenly when she's charged with a crime, we discover that the narrative flips and it's quite different. She's now saying that, in fact, during this time, she was being controlled by a powerful man. And it's really difficult, of course, for us to reconcile those stories. And we don't know what the jury is going to conclude. They may well decide that her current story is so at odds with the prior face that she showed the world that she's lying now. But what's interesting to me is the availability of both stories and how our law continues to see women, when they fall from grace and they fall from power, as potentially being vulnerable and susceptible to the machinations of the men in their lives.
Right. You know, not many white-collar crimes in Silicon Valley get prosecuted, and some have argued that Holmes is being held to more exacting standards because she is a woman. Your thoughts on this particular argument, and what does history tell us?
So there's no question that she's being held to more exacting standards because she's a woman. She was aiming to enter a world that was dominated by men. And so one of the things that we can see, and she's been criticized for this, though I don't think it's fair, is that she was in some ways a Steve Jobs wannabe or a knockoff.
Right.
You know, the allegations are, and I don't know if these things are all true, that she lowered her voice so that she would appear to be more masculine. She adopted clothing that was the uniform that was worn by successful men. So plainly, she's entering a world that is governed by male standards, and that's really difficult for her because she's a woman. She did enter that world, and she was succeeding quite beautifully up until the time she's accused of lying, and she may well have been. And then when she's caught lying and she falls from grace, we have the sense that she's being scrutinized more closely because she's a woman. Of course, that has happened across time. Whenever we have a powerful female emerge, and then we discover, oh, in fact, this person's a criminal, it's precisely because she's a woman that we get very interested. Women are not supposed to be powerful. Women are not supposed to be criminal.
Yes. Also, I'd like for you to comment on something that we've been seeing in Silicon Valley over the last few years. Yes, the rules have changed, but many women have talked about, women CEOs in the tech world have talked about constantly being compared to Holmes. She's brought up during investor and pitch meetings, and the only association is that Holmes is a woman and
right.
They're women. Do you think that there's some sort of societal glee in a way of watching a powerful woman, especially one who dared to join this boys' club, fall from grace? It's like a lot of women are atoning for what is being alleged of Holmes at this very moment in Silicon Valley.
Yes. One of the most disquieting aspects of the case for me is to watch the sense of glee that you described, or what we might call schadenfreude, that emotion that we have when someone powerful falls from grace, and we don't feel sympathy or empathy for them. Instead, we just feel this sense of relish to see them. They had risen above their place, and now they've fallen. And of course, the concern that we have, feminists have, is that people will react to the Holmes story as if it is exemplary of women generally, that people will react by saying, see, we told you so. When women rise to places of power, this is what happens. They are not to be trusted. They are likely to be deceptive. They are likely to lie, and they are likely to do those things at the behest of the men in their lives. So yes, there's a concern. The women that follow are worried, and my students are worried. I worry on behalf of the upcoming generations that people will point to Holmes as a parable or a moral, if you will. See, this is what happens when you trust a woman and put her in a position of power.
Hmm. You know, Anne, one of the main mantras of the feminist movement, especially in recent years, is believe all victims. How does that butt up against this concept of accountability in the Holmes case?
That's a fantastic question, and it's one that requires a nuanced answer. It's not, you can't answer that question with a soundbite or by tweeting. At this point, we do not know the truth in terms of what went on in Holmes's private life. We don't know what kind of abuse she was subjected to. And so the question then becomes, are we more willing to accept those stories from women than we are from men? So, and the answer right now is that we are inclined to think that women, because of their experiences as women, are likely to be subject to abuse that then leads them to be weak and to commit crimes where men may not. At the end of the day, that serves men's interests because we view them as powerful, as responsible. They are people who are willing and able to stand up to temptation against pressure where women are seen as weak and succumbing. But that to me is what is so striking. You know, women have been kept out of these powerful roles for years on the grounds that they were likely to be subordinate to their husbands. They were not likely to follow the best judgment in the world because they were going to be preoccupied by their domestic sphere. We ostensibly have cleared all that away, and then suddenly we have Holmes who's saying, see, it happened to me, and there we go again.
That was Anne Coughlin, professor of law at the University of Virginia. She studies criminal law and feminist jurisprudence. Thank you so much, Anne, for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
So what comes next for Facebook? The company is still on the hot seat after an ex-employee leaked internal documents about the social harm that Facebook and Instagram inflict, and then she talked about it to Congress. On Sunday, Facebook's Vice President Nick Clegg told CNN the company would address some concerns, but not everything.
We cannot, with a wave of the wand, make everyone's life perfect. What we can do is improve our products so that our products are as safe and as enjoyable to use wherever we can improve them.
Okay, let's bring in Elizabeth Dwoskin. She's Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi, Elizabeth. Okay, you've done a lot of reporting since whistleblower Frances Haugen went public. You've seen internal message boards and goodbye messages from people who quit. What's the picture you see?
I see that a company that's been under siege for many years, probably dating back to 2017, with revelations that Russians sow disinformation on the company's platform. And since then, you know, they talked about a reckoning, and they attracted a lot of people who wanted to work there who were idealistic. But what happened was is they haven't been ready, actually, to make the changes and implement, like, basically the reforms. Like, they hired all these researchers, these idealistic people who said, we can improve this platform for society, but then they didn't listen to them.
So tell me more about, I guess, the people you've talked to, the messages you've read about these frustrated ideological workers, some of whom quit. I mean, do you sense kind of burnout, frustration? This is not the job I thought I was going to do?
Yeah, I think this is a lot of people who recommended, you know, would spend years. We reported on someone, you know, who spent years studying hate speech on the platform, a couple of years. And, you know, they discovered, like, okay, we can make these tweaks to the algorithm that will actually really cut down on hate speech. And yes, it's going to end up probably getting a lot more false positives, censor some legitimate speech. But there's a huge benefit in right here. And, you know, that's just one example. And that was pushed up all the way to Zuckerberg. And the answer that that the people got was, no, he's not ready to do that. And, you know, so it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. So I think you see people who do work, and it's kind of a small number of people who work in reform in these companies, in social media companies.
Yeah.
And those people really get really frustrated and burned out because it's the companies are, and I don't want to put them all together in one brush, but particularly Facebook is not able to make the changes.
Now, on the other hand, you also spoke to Facebook employees who suggest this public airing of grievances might make it harder to reform things inside the company. Yeah, I mean, a contrarian take on how things may go?
I think if you look at Mark Zuckerberg's only statement that he's made about this whistleblower, you know, he said a lot of things, but one thing he said was that this kind of scrutiny actually disincentivizes companies to invest in research like this, where they look under the hood at their problems. He said, we're still going to continue with it, but, you know, a lot of people in Facebook saw that as maybe a veiled threat. Like, you know, maybe they were going to invest in all this research. And by the way, if you talk to these researchers, they'll say that there were constant reorganizations. They constantly had to justify their work based on a budget. Like, how much is it going to cost to add this label that's going to improve misinformation? So you have externally the companies telling the world that they've invested heavily in this, but but what's actually happening in those divisions is very different. And that says a lot about whether the company can police itself. It speaks to a lot of the bigger questions that we're wrestling with around social media companies and how they should be regulated.
I mean, well, we have inside Facebook this push and pull, this apparent debate about whether reform is going to happen. But of course, Congress has its own thoughts. Is there a sense in Silicon Valley that maybe finally regulation is likely coming from Washington?
I think there's a sense that regulation might come more likely in Europe than in Congress. I mean, we still have our polarized Congress, and that's what's so interesting about these hearings. I definitely feel like, you know, having watched a lot of hearings with Zuckerberg, having been at the moment where a lot of people said in Silicon Valley and outside, is this the moment when regulation is going to come? Is this the moment, you know, when it's going to finally, you know, when there's going to be, you know, change? Remember, this industry is not banking. It's not healthcare. It's actually completely unregulated. And yet it's the most powerful industry in the world right now, arguably. And but I think that the same divisions and polarizations among lawmakers about how to regulate speech, especially under the country with the First Amendment, continue to exist. However, we're on the brink of seeing major regulatory change in Europe, in the UK, and even in India. And particularly what's going on in the UK looks pretty likely to pass. And those rules will actually really punish companies for misinformation that appears on their platforms. They're going to be required legally to have something called a duty of care, potentially. And that could be a game changer, because if they fail in their obligations, it could cost them 10% of global revenue.
Yeah, well, that could be quite the hammer. Well, we got to run. Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.